Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As each day passes, we're learning more about the people police say may have been involved in the mass shooting that killed six people and injured a dozen others in downtown Sacramento. Understandably, with ongoing investigations, police can only say so much. In my conversation with Sacramento Police Chief Kathy Lester yesterday, she acknowledged that she's limited in what she can release and won't jeopardize a case that will eventually be handed over to the Sacramento County District Attorney's Office. But a recent stop at the Sacramento County Courthouse by CAP Radio's Nicole Nixon revealed some new information about one of the men arrested in connection with the shooting that Sunday morning. Information that has raised eyebrows, especially among political candidates running on a platform of public safety, looking at this as an example of the state of California or their political opponents being too soft on crime. But it's not that cut and dry. Nicole joins us now to dig into the details and the complexities. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So before we explore this criminal history, can you refresh everyone's memory? Who is the suspect that we're talking about, 27-year-old Smiley Martin, and why is he in police custody?
Well, police believe that Smiley Martin was one of the five suspected shooters in a gunfight that broke out last Sunday in the early hours of the morning, which left six people dead and a dozen others wounded. Police have also said that they believe this is a shootout, basically, between rival gangs. Smiley Martin faces charges for illegally possessing a firearm and possession of a machine gun. Police say it was a modified handgun, you know, modified to fire automatically. And Smiley Martin was injured in the shooting. He remains in the hospital, and police say he'll be booked to the Sacramento County Jail when he makes a recovery and is released.
And there are a total of three suspects that Sacramento police investigators believe actively opened fire during that shooting, but none of them at this time are facing homicide charges. What led you to head over to the courthouse, start looking through documents, and what did you learn?
Well, I went to look at Smiley Martin's criminal history because of the story that he had been sentenced to a 10-year term in prison in 2018, and 4 years later was involved in this. And there was a lot of confusion about how that could be, a lot of people saying he was released early. I just went to find out what I could learn. And, you know, Smiley Martin's criminal history, it began before he turned 18. He spent some time in juvenile detention. Those records are sealed. But soon after he turned 18, you know, he started having run-ins with police and the law. He spent some time in jail for illegally transporting an assault-style weapon. Later in 2013, he was sentenced to 2 years for robbing a Walmart electronics department, along with several other people. This 2018 sentence stems from a 2017 case where he's arrested for domestic violence, assault, and kidnapping. Prosecutors say that he hit his girlfriend and dragged her to his car and then beat her with a belt. And this is the case, again, where his 10-year sentence stems from. And I also kind of looked into the file of his brother, DeAndre Martin, who's another suspect charged with gun crimes in the shooting. And again, no one has been charged with homicide in this event. But these two brothers, you know, have a history of cycling in and out of jail and prison for assault and drug charges in both California and Arizona.
Mm. And Smiley Martin is now 27 years old. Let's focus on that 10-year prison sentence. How long did he actually serve, and when was he released?
Right. This is where it gets confusing, because Smiley Martin was sentenced to 10 years in prison, and under state law, he served his time. He was released February 8th of this year. He completed his sentence under California law. But does that mean he actually spent 10 consecutive years in prison? It does not. And here's why. It's really complicated. And I think this case just shows how complicated some of these criminal justice reform laws can get. So California law allows inmates to earn time for good behavior in custody. This is often referred to as good time credit or day for a day, you know, meaning for every day or every 2 or 3 days a nonviolent offender spends in custody where they have no issues, you know, they don't get into trouble, they are able to knock an extra day off their sentence. And that is not new. I believe that's been around in some fashion since like the 80s. So Martin served 254 days behind bars during his trial, and with good conduct, that was doubled to 508 days, or almost a year and a half. And then in early 2018, he's sentenced. He serves 4 more years. And with time doubled and, you know, maybe some extra credits for completing a program, that adds up to a 10-year sentence. And that's how you can serve 10 years in 4 or 5 years.
And so essentially he was released roughly 2 months prior to the deadly mass shooting that happened in downtown Sacramento off K Street. There was also a plea deal that was struck with the district attorney's office, which is led by Sacramento District Attorney Anne Marie Schubert, also running for California Attorney General as an independent. What do we know about this plea deal handled by her office?
Right. So the reason Smiley Martin is able to earn a day for a day in prison is due to the fact that he enters prison considered a nonviolent offender under state law. And the crimes he was convicted of under Prop 57 are not considered violent felonies. This is assault and domestic violence. Now, he had been charged initially with violent kidnapping, and that is considered a violent crime. But that kidnapping charge was dismissed as part of a plea deal with the DA's office in this case. So I talked with Lori Levinson about this. She's a former federal prosecutor, and she thinks that Martin got a pretty good deal from the DA's office.
Given the nature of the offense, I'm still curious as to why he got the plea deal he did. I mean, I don't know whether there were problems with the evidence, problems with the victim testifying, but the assessment of whether somebody's going to be an unreasonable risk of violence really starts at that stage.
And, you know, Levinson also said that the DA's office ended up sending mixed signals about Martin by giving him this plea deal, which ends up with him being sentenced as a nonviolent offender, and then turning around a few years later when he's up for parole review and telling the parole board that he's a violent criminal who will break the law if he's released. And by the way, in 2021, he was denied that parole.
Yeah, there's obviously a disconnect there. Has Schubert commented publicly about this plea deal, or even her opponent, who's the current attorney general, Rob Bonta?
Neither of them have commented on this plea deal, but Schubert's chief deputy, Rod Norgaard, sent a statement to CAP Radio where, you know, he said there are often obstacles in prosecuting domestic violence cases, including the cooperation of a victim. Norgaard said they were trying to hold Martin accountable with the evidence that they had available in the case, and they believe that the 10-year sentence accomplished that.
There's also a lot of discussion about Proposition 57. Can you just remind us what Prop 57 is in terms of criminal justice reform?
Right. So Prop 57 did a few things. It was approved by voters in 2016. First, it allowed the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, or CDCR, to expand the rate at which some inmates could earn that good time credit. It also made credits available for completing, you know, educational or rehabilitative programs, things like earning a high school diploma or a college degree, completing behavioral treatment, being on a fire crew, other programs, you know, designed to help inmates find jobs when they're released, basically meant to incentivize people in prison to do these programs so that they could get out sooner and have some life skills when they are released. And then it also made it so that nonviolent offenders could be eligible for parole after completing their longest sentence if they're charged for multiple crimes. And that was a factor in Martin's case. You know, he came up for a parole review early last year. That's when the DA's office sent that letter outlining his criminal history, urging the parole board to keep him in prison. And he did stay in prison and serve the remainder of his term. And I'll also point out only a small fraction of these inmates are actually granted parole under this provision. It was only about 10% last year.
Yeah. I mean, another part of this, the sentence coincided with the pandemic, and there were emergency rules that were adopted by the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. What role, if any, did that play in the time served?
Yeah. So last spring, just to back up a bit, CDCR announced that it was going to up the rate at which inmates could earn these good time credits. So when Prop 57 went into effect in 2017, the rate was 33% for nonviolent offenders and 20% for violent offenders. So that means if you're a nonviolent offender, You earn 1 day of credit for every 3 good days you have in custody, and that's 5 days if you're a violent offender. So last spring, there were COVID outbreaks in prisons. CDCR has been under pressure to reduce its inmate population for, over a decade already, and they announced that they were increasing those rates to 50% for nonviolent offenders and 33% for violent. So basically, inmates can earn these good time credits faster, shave time off their sentences if they're well behaved.
What are the future of these emergency rules? Are they going to be extended or will they go away?
Well, that remains to be seen. Schubert, D.A. Schubert, has led several dozen other district attorneys in suing to try to stop them from remaining in effect. Those were emergency regulations. They were approved late last year, and CDCR is trying to make them permanent. So there's been a public comment period that wrapped up yesterday. There is a public hearing today at 10 a.m. so people can weigh in via phone there. On these credits, there's the good time credits, there's the rehabilitative programs. I have to say I've been talking to criminal justice reform advocates, and they're pretty defensive of these, especially for the rehabilitative programs. They say they really can make a difference and change people for the better while they're in prison. And they don't want people, they worry that people will cherry pick, this one case where someone got out of prison and was involved in a horrible incident a few weeks later. So I talked to Sam Lewis. He leads the Anti-Recidivism Coalition. He cautioned against, rushing to undo some of these and going back to just very long sentences where people have no incentive to complete these programs.
The way our system works is we arrest someone, we put them in jail, and we hold them accountable. That doesn't change a person. Now, if we arrest someone, we incarcerate them, and we guide them to programs where they begin to hold themselves accountable for their action, that changes a person. And so the long sentences don't have an effect on that. That does not stop people from committing crimes. Resources do.
With all of that, Nicole, you really unpacked a lot. This is so layered and complicated. Ultimately, how do you see this horrible tragedy, which literally happened blocks from the state capitol, showing up in the political conversations as we lead up to a June primary and then November? Starting off with the AG race, attorney general.
Yeah, I think it really amps up a lot of these races, especially the attorney general's race, where District Attorney Schubert is running. She was already planning to go after Rob Bonta and Democrats generally as being soft on crime and touting her record, and putting away criminals like the Golden State Killer. And this was already going to be an issue. But, polls are showing that crime continues to rise as an issue for voters. I think it may also affect the sheriff's race. These people are deal more directly with safety on the streets, along with city and county officials. And then I also think there will be some wrestling with this in the state legislature. Republicans have really been amping up pressure to revisit some of these laws, reduce these opportunities for inmates to earn credits and increasing sentence enhancements. But top legislative Democrats really haven't given any signals yet that they'll move to undo or loosen any of these laws that they've passed in recent years. But again, polls are showing that voters are increasingly concerned about crime and public safety.
Yeah, we've been having lengthy discussions here about the rise in gun violence across the country and in California as well. What is the governor saying about this? Has Governor Newsom said anything in the week since or week and a half since?
Well, the governor released a statement about the shooting. He was out on vacation with his family and he just got back a couple days ago. He's really been pushing the need for nationwide gun reform. Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg was out supporting a proposal that Newsom has to increase behavioral health treatment, to kind of reduce people going into the prison system in the first place. So there's a lot of policy layers here, and I think a lot of debate we'll have on things touching on this topic in the months to come.
And the weeks to come as we get to June. You're going to be very busy, Nicole. Thanks for helping break all that down.
Thanks so much.
And you can read more of Nicole Nixon's reporting at capradio.org, and she is Cap Radio's politics reporter. Up next, we're going to learn about a unique program for veterans and first responders in Sacramento that is centered on moral injury and how it differs from PTSD. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. There's a unique center for healing for veterans and first responders in Sacramento County. The Center for Post-Traumatic Growth opened in 2019, just before the pandemic in Rancho Cordova, to offer treatment for moral injury, which is a new field of psychology. In the time since, dozens have completed or are on their way to unparalleled healing. The nonprofit origin story begins with Dr. Melinda Keenan, a psychologist formerly with the VA and now the executive director of the Center for Post-Traumatic Growth. Dr. Keenan, thank you for taking the time.
Oh, so glad to be here, Vicki. Thank you.
Let's start from the beginning. What were you seeing in your field that was lacking and ultimately led to this center?
Yeah, well, as you said, I was a psychologist in the VA system for a number of years, 19 years, and I was aware of some crucial gaps in the services offered. For example, family treatment. We were really looking at a model where we were treating the veteran without the family. And I think that the family obviously is crucial to healing folks with trauma. Yeah, you can't treat someone with trauma in a vacuum. So that was one thing. The other thing is that as I worked with the veterans over the years, we started to understand that there was more to trauma and the injuries that trauma inflicts on people beyond sort of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress, okay? Beyond anxiety, beyond the hyperarousal, and that there were really some deeper core issues that were in these folks, really a soul wound, okay? Mm. Something much deeper. And so the field has finally started to come around to this idea that there are these core issues of unresolved loss, guilt, and shame. And they've started to look at that, and they've termed that moral injury. And so moral injury is something that happens in people of service who are exposed to traumatic events in which they are forced by their role to break their own moral values. And so specifically how we conceptualize moral injury in our program is that it's a broken relationship between people. Okay, so you feel as if you've perpetrated harm in some way against somebody else, either through action or inaction, okay? So your role doesn't allow you to do what you would do if you were, you know, if you were just Vicki versus if you were, you know, Vicki first responder.
Right.
Okay. So the program that we use at the Center for Post-Traumatic Growth is one that I developed with my colleagues over these 20 years of talking with veterans and first responders. Okay. So this is a bottom-up program. Mm. This is what they have taught me about what they need. This is not a top-down where the psychologists up in the ivory tower, you know, say, this is what we need to do to heal you, right? This was about what they taught me.
And as you so well put it, I mean, it's healing their soul, and it's a new field of psychology. You spent nearly 20 years with the VA. How did you discover moral injury?
Well, that's the thing, is that we haven't really discovered moral injury. Moral injury is something that's been around since people have been around, okay? So you can go back into the ancient text, look at the Greek tragedies and things, and so much of the writings there is about moral injury, is about when people go to war or people hurt each other or do things bad to one another, that there are emotional consequences for that. And so I think that it's just taken the field this long to really sort of grapple with this and identify this as an issue, because we've been so focused, I think, on the post-traumatic stress problems and symptoms. Now, don't get me wrong, post-traumatic stress exists and is a true thing and is a very painful condition also. But I think that the treatment approach that we've used with post-traumatic stress is kind of almost like a 30,000 foot flyover. And the moral injury is really more of a deep dive down into, again, what it means to be a human being. You have to grapple with spiritual issues. You have to grapple with moral issues and what it means to be human and to feel like you've failed or harmed somebody. So it's not a symptom reduction kind of approach. It's much more of a, like I said, a deeper dive into these issues.
Yeah, rebuilding bonds that maybe have been broken between human beings. And what you're talking about is the shame that disconnects people and comes along with making those decisions as a result of being a veteran or being a first responder. When you were listening to veterans at the VA, I mean, you touched upon this, but if you can expand, what did you learn from them in terms of moral injury when you're like something clicked with you and you created this center?
Well, I think, again, it was sort of a longer term process of me really getting to understand what the core of their pain is, So a lot of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress, for example, are skill sets that people learn in order to survive combat, or trauma too, But these other issues are things that have to do with being a person of service, and what makes you good at being a person of service is what makes you vulnerable to moral injury. So it's the most principled, competent, honorable people that get wounded so badly because of this. So they have to break these values that are so dear to them. And so one of the most important things that we do in the center is, because we look at moral injury as broken relationships between people, everything we do is around relationship, okay? It's about rebuilding, it's about reconnection, okay? So we do group treatment. And of course, at first, folks who've been traumatized don't want to do group because they feel like we're going to be putting them in there with a bunch of people who won't understand, because they've already run into people who don't understand. Because if you haven't been there, if you haven't experienced it, you really can't understand. So we put them in with what I call a group of worthy others, people who've walked the same walk, who have experienced the same things, and who are grappling with the same kinds of issues. And so pretty immediately they go, oh, this is different. And they say, wow, that person could be it. That person's in my head. That what that person said, I have said a million times to myself. So it becomes a really close-knit group. And if you think about how veterans and first responders work, they work as a team too. They can consider each other family. They have really strong bonds. And so we treat as they fight, right? So that's a really important aspect of our program. And then the other aspect is, many times these people, the injury, like I said, it's broken relationships between people. So something happened between you and somebody else, but very often that person could be dead, or that person may be inaccessible to you in many other ways. So our...
Oh, Melinda, your audio has gone out. Can you hear us?
Letter writing technique.
Oh, can you repeat that? Because it's so important what you just said. You got cut off when we were discussing that the reality that many of the people that they have harmed or that they have lost, they're not accessible to them. And you have a really good tool of healing for letter writing. If you can just explain what the intention of that again.
Sure. So, trauma doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's between you and somebody else. And so the idea here is that person may be dead. That person may not be accessible to you in some way because they're in another country or, you name it, right? So what we use is a letter writing technique, because the letters allow the person who feels like they've hurt somebody or lost somebody to have their say to that person. And the letters, they transcend time and space and dimension, if you think about it, right? It goes out. So they write the letter, and then what they do is they bring it in and they read it in the group. So they are putting it out into the universe. They are sharing it, and they're sharing it with each other and with the person that the letter is to. Okay. A lot of trauma programs will have them write a trauma account. So they write about the trauma. The letter writing is very different because they're writing to the person that is involved in their trauma. Mm. So again, that's where the interpersonal piece comes in. And that's where our program is unique. Even the people that are talking about moral injury in the field, I think, have not personally figured out that particular piece of that this is between people. It's not an intrapersonal problem. It's not a problem just with the first responder. It's a problem of a broken relationship.
Yeah. And with that, it's not like people just live in houses with their doors closed in their own room. I mean, it doesn't work like that. I mean, there are families and loved ones that are part of this. How does this extend to family at your center?
Oh, yeah. Well, you can imagine living with somebody who feels like, you know, the way that they describe often their inner feeling is they say things like, you know, I'm a monster. I can't love. I have no heart. I became an animal. And they often feel like they don't deserve anything good and they don't deserve to be in society anymore. Okay. Or they feel like they've failed in some core way. So shame pulls them away from the healing part of their families, pulls them away from the healing part of relationships. So you can imagine what that's like to be the spouse or child of somebody of service that has that, is carrying that burden. And it ripples out across all aspects of their lives. And so, of course, the loved ones are in that really tight circle in the middle there, right? So they're very often affected by this. And so we do some work with them as well in terms of educating them about moral injury and post-traumatic stress, and the fact that these folks are they're not broken. They're not, in fact, moral injury is not a diagnosis. It's not a, you know, it's a soul wound. It's what happens to people when good people are forced into situations where they feel like they've done harm. So, it's a soul wound. And so, the idea here is to help the families start to understand that and help the veterans and first responders realize that they're not alone and it's not that they're not a bad person. In fact, they're very good people. And that's exactly why they're there, because they're good people. You know, sociopaths don't get morally injured and they don't get PTSD, right? Because they don't have a heart and they don't have a soul and they don't have morals. But people, human beings, are the ones that... good human beings are the ones that get injured in these ways. Okay, so the family, it's really about education. And again, it's about getting them to reconnect with them and each other and to realize that they're not alone and they're in a community of people that are really, really special, actually. You know, they serve us selflessly and bear these wounds so that a lot of us don't have to.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Melinda Keenan, a psychologist and executive director of the Center for Post-Traumatic Growth in Sacramento County. To your knowledge, is this happening elsewhere? I know that moral injury, you know, it has been around cerebrally and discussions for a while, but in terms of what you are doing, was there a template or a framework that you could go off of?
No, this is just something that kind of evolved organically from my work with the veterans and their discussions with me, sharing the realities of what they deal with and what they face day in and day out in their heads and their hearts. And the letter writing just sort of came to me as a as a way to connect these people together. Again, the relationship piece. And I think that that is at the core of what's going on here. And like I said, there's not a lot of other programs that have kind of adopted that idea. I think they're still thinking about it as something that happens to a person of service. And so we have to just deal with that person and figure out a way for them to find some self-forgiveness, right? But in order to find self-forgiveness or to feel forgiven, I believe that the folks that I work with have to actually do something that makes them feel worthy of being forgiven or forgiving themselves, okay? So the letter writing is a way to say, I did this to you, I'm so sorry, and please forgive me. You know, if I could have done it differently, I would have, or I wish I could have done this or that or the other, you know, but I couldn't. And so the most amazing part of this whole thing too, Vicky, is that almost always when they write these letters and they read them aloud, there is some event that occurs. I call it a transformation event. Some event that occurs in their lives that let them know that the person that they were writing to got the letter, okay? Most often it's a dream of some kind where the person comes back to them in a way where, because typically with traumatic events, what happens is it gets burned into the limbic system. And so it's not a thought or a memory like regular memories. It's something that's burned into the limbic system. And so it plays like a DVD over and over and over. So the traumatic event, once it gets triggered, it just starts and it tells the story in the same way over and over. And there's something about the process of writing the letter and reading it aloud that I think shifts it out of that kind of trauma track, so to speak. And it allows them to access these people in a new way. Okay. So I think when we talked earlier, I think I told you one of the stories. I've got a few of them, but if you'd like me to, I can give you an example.
Yeah, please.
I'll give you a little different one this time. So I had a Korean War veteran who was, he had a buddy, and his buddy was, had they called him UT, and they were out on, they both loved to fish. So they spent a lot of time talking about fishing. Okay. And so to pass the time. So anyway, one day they were out on a patrol, and they had a large truck with a 50 caliber machine gun mounted on the back. And the truck had a bunch of gasoline that it was carrying. And UT was on the gun, and a rocket propelled grenade came in and struck the truck with the gasoline, and it exploded, and UT was engulfed in flames, and my veteran saw him burn to death. In that process, my veteran also flinched and kind of ducked down behind the wheel of the truck. And so he labeled himself a coward, because he felt like if he hadn't done that, that maybe he could have stopped it, right? Maybe he could have gotten to UT. Now, we know in our head, right, logically, the rocket comes in, there's no way he's going to be able to save UT, right? But this is the difference between moral injury and looking at understanding that is going to be the response versus some of the cognitive therapies that we use for PTSD, where we try to reason through with people and say, well, you couldn't have done anything. That's what we say, right? But that doesn't translate to people's hearts and souls. They believe that, you know, that they didn't do what they should have done, okay? So in our approach, we say, okay, so you feel guilty, so what are we going to have them do, Vicky? What do you think we might have them do?
Write a letter.
Write a letter. And who would he write that letter to?
To UT.
Exactly. And what might he say in that letter?
I think he would apologize and say what he would have liked to have done better or a different outcome, and just really be open and vulnerable and share that with others in the group who have had their own unique experiences, but they're all connected by that sense of loss and guilt and shame.
Exactly. Very, very good, Vicky. Look, you're an expert already. And so anyway, yeah. And do you think it might be important for him to say to UT that he feels like a coward?
Yeah, I think that is important because it's good to get that out and to kind of change the limbic system and that replaying DVD that's going on, breaking that momentum.
Exactly, exactly. And so whether we believe he's a coward, whether we believe he could have gotten to save UT, that doesn't matter. It's what he feels in his heart. And so we have to go with that, but give him the path to then ask for forgiveness from the person, the only person who can give him that forgiveness, which is UT, right? So the veteran read this story in the group. And of course, all the other folks in the group have very similar incidents, right? The details are different, but the core issues are still the same. So at the end, okay, he reads it aloud. A couple weeks later, he comes back and he said, to the group, he said, I had a dream I want to share with you guys. And we said, okay. So he said, in my dream, I went out to my mailbox, and in my mailbox was a card. And he described the card open, you know, not like right to left, but it was an up and down one, right? And on one side of the card was a picture. And guess who the picture was?
UT.
Picture of UT. Was he burned? Was he re-burning? Was he dying over and over? No, he was smiling, right? Happy, healthy. And in the card, he said that UT told him that he loved him and that he missed him and that everything was going great for him because he was living on a houseboat surrounded by fish.
Wow.
And he looked at me, my veteran, and he said, I know where that card came from. And he said, it came from heaven. So is he ever going to forget UT burning up? Is that ever going to go away? No. But what does he have now? He has literally a card and a picture from UT saying, I'm okay. I'm not burning. I'm living here on a boat surrounded by fish, and I still miss you and love you.
Wow. Dr. Keenan, we're going to end on that note. What a wonderful story. And thank you so much for all of the work that you do in starting this nonprofit.
Well, thank you so much for having me and letting me get the word out.
Yep, it's important. Dr. Melinda Keenan is a psychologist and executive director of the Center for Post-Traumatic Growth in Rancho Cordova. We have a link to the website if you want more information on our Insight page at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. I have a pretty cool assignment here at Cap Radio. Each year, NPR's annual Tiny Desk Contest comes knocking on modern music director Nick Bruner's door, delivering hundreds of local entry submissions across California. Nick parcels out Northern California's talent and is left with a volume of talented local musicians. So many that if he sorted them through himself, he would just be greedy and selfish. So he is sharing the musical love, and he asks a few people to step in and help select their own favorites. So Nick and I have narrowed down our 2022 Tiny Desk Contest entrance selections down to our top three. And in the spirit of sharing, we're going to share them with you. So Cap Radio's Nick Bruner joins us now. Good morning, Nick.
Well, hi, Vicky. First of all, I like that you made it sound like you had an assignment, like I assigned it to you, like I have some kind of control over the work you do here. So no, thank you for helping out this year.
I am so excited. I've been watching Tiny Desk for years and years and years and years. Okay, so let's just kind of riff back and forth. Let's start with our first top pick. You go for it.
Okay.
Go for it.
So for my first pick, it's somebody who I didn't know anything about before the Tiny Desk contest this year. Their name is Coco Liani, and I was delighted to, once I watched her video, I was just like, man, this is great. And then as I kept going through all the submissions throughout California, I saw her pop up on another one with yet another Tiny Desk entrant. So there's a lot of collaboration going on. I think you'll hear more about an artist called Jakari Smith in the future mm-hmm. on this program. So, but she contributes to his video. But back to Coco's video. I love the flow of this piece. There's a sparse beat. Her voice is hypnotic. This is called TikTok.
I'm a flower in a field of wings. The bees, they travel just to be with me. They tell me stories about the willow trees and how happy the birds are when they sing. They show me what it's like to fly. I ain't been this high in a long, long time. Late at night, the moon hears my cries, but she don't dry them. The demons, she say, fight them. When I get scared, I hide them. I don't really think I mind them, cause they're lonely like me. They guide me in my dreams to a river that's flowing.
What I love about this video is that it's kind of deconstructed, because sometimes you get a really highly produced Tiny Desk entrance, and she's literally just like sitting at her desk, and it's her voice is just amazing, and the rhythm as well.
Yes, absolutely, and it's hypnotic just to watch her perform too. The facial expressions that she goes through—it's just—it's impossible for me not to be captivated. And it's really short; it's like 2 minutes and change tops. So yeah, really good stuff from Coco Liai.
All right, my first pick is Jamesy Little While. So let's take a little listen, and then we'll unpack it.
All right.
Small talk, yeah, I know I made a mess of it. But if there's something that you wanna tell me, please just let me know. And keep it real, cause I know things have gone awry. It's not my intention to float by. The comfort that we seem to be basking in could maybe use a help of crowbars. Just a little space, just a little time, just to get a little wiser. Puppy love's caught me sprung, ain't gonna lie to ya. I'll take my chances on this roundabout. Or maybe I should take my time, could take a little while.
You may hear a little bit of an accent. He grew up in London, relocated to Roseville as a teen. You have talked about him before joining us here on Insight. He's had a really great evolution and career that started here in Northern California and obviously has grown. You've been following him in recent years. What stands out to you about his evolution as an artist?
Well, I really love where he's at as an artist right now. There is such a, I don't know, like his... The song structure and the tone is just more my speed, particularly. Like, I like how it can go from aggressive, but it's really confident and fun. It's got some great beats to it. And he's gone from kind of like his style has changed so much. He was like a kind of more of what you might expect out of a typical kind of pop act maybe 10 years ago. And now he just feels like he's much more of his own. He's found his voice.
Yeah. And you can just see how much fun they're having. All right, what's your second pick, Nick?
All right, so up next, number two, this is Pharaoh and the Peach Leaves. I don't always go in for Americana, but I do love bands like the Drive-By Truckers, Trampled by Turtles, Lap Steel Guitar, and early Wilco, so I don't know, maybe I do. Pharaoh and the Peach Leaves are five guys out of Nevada City. This is their track, All Blue.
I can see why you opened a little piece of your heart for Americana for this selection.
Well, these guys sound like they have been together for a while, or that they're seasoned enough to make it sound like they've been together for a while. There's just such tight instrumentation on that piece, and just enough jam band for my taste. And a great sense of humor, by the way. If you watch the video, it bookends the entry. It's well worth your time.
Yeah, it really is important to watch the videos, and we have them all on our Insight page in today's show. And that brings me to my next pick. It's Lillian Francis. She's from Davis. She has been around for a few years. This is her sixth Tiny Desk entry. But you got to watch the video. I mean, she is singing on a porta ledge. She has merged rock climbing with her passion for music. A fear of heights may be a little weary watching it. It just was really exceptional, the production that went into this Tiny Desk. And if you listen to her, you're going to hear some wind in the background because she's literally hanging off Sugarloaf. It's a big granite boulder in Tahoe off Highway 50. So let's take a listen.
That grief storm fuel, I'ma run, run, run till I break my heels. What you doing? You should join me. Ain't got a long ride ahead, but I could use the company. I got 6 strings, 10 fingers, 10 toes. I'ma run these souls as far as they can go, cause
you can hear that wind, you know, and really, I mean, you can't discount her voice. I mean, when she also talks at length about herself and what inspired her, she's a Taylor Swift fan, but then she discovered electronic music. And then this is what we're listening to now, which is beautiful.
Lillian was a huge part of our first endeavor into Tiny Desk, covering it 5 years ago. Her initial video that I saw blew me away, and I've been following her work ever since and going back. Gravestone Feel, the track you just heard, is an early piece from her electronic career as well.
All right, what's your last pick?
All right, for me, it's New Spell. Leanne Kelly is the voice behind this band, and it's just warm, introspective, and so well produced. This track is called Beautiful World.
It's a perfect song title, Beautiful World. I feel like I'm surrounded by her music and her voice.
The studio music of New Spell always has these like really lovely electronic textures going on. Here we just find Kelly on her own, just her and an electric piano. And really captivating stuff.
So this is just the start, Nick. We're going to be doing this every Thursday with the other people that you asked to join in on the fun. So what happens next?
Next Thursday, you're going to meet Tara Lopez, if you haven't already. And Tara Lopez is a dynamo, a human dynamo of a musician and an artist. And she's coming in with her top picks from this year's Tiny Desk entrance.
I actually take it as a compliment that you think it's the weekend right now talking with me here on Insight. So
it has a lovely feel about this this part of the show, Vicky. Thanks for having me on.
All right. How long does this contest process take? I mean, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but when could we find out a winner across the country?
I'm not sure I'm allowed to say that. I'm not sure if I actually know. I would expect sometime in the mid to late spring. I think that's as coy as I can be about that with the information that I have within me. So
thank you so much, Nick. Mm-hmm. That is Cap Radio Modern Music Director Nick Bruner. You can listen to Nick every Saturday as the host of Hey Listen. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producer Nick Dobis and managing editor Arms Sarkissian. Our digital team is Megan Minata, Insight's technical director Mark Jones, and our engineer Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday. In the meantime, here is more of Pharaoh and the Peach Leaves.